We're going to talk a little bit about a variety of different things, and it's kind of going to be like the four actuarials that went duck hunting. And if you know actuarials, they're the guys that figure out how long on the average people live. And these four actuarials went duck hunting. This is another duck hunting joke. They were out in a blind, and there was one duck in the middle of the pond, and the duck flew up, and all four actuarials rose together and fired at the same time. And one hit 2 feet above the duck, one hit 2 feet below the duck, one hit 2 feet to the left of the duck, and one hit 2 feet to the right of the duck. And everybody was ecstatic. Of course, the duck was happy because it flew away, but all four actuarials were happy because on the average, they killed the duck. And so I hope, on the average, we answer most of your questions today. I want to start, I guess, by telling you one of my favorite estate jokes, and there was an elderly woman who had a pretty large estate, and she called her lawyer and her pastor and her doctor in to visit her before she was going to die, and she said, "Gentlemen, I'm getting ready to die, and I want to take it with me." And he said, "So I'm going to give you each $200,000, and I want you to put the cash in an envelope and put it in my casket when I die." Sure enough, 2 weeks later, she died. And so the three gentlemen came to the funeral, and they had an open casket. And one at a time, they walked up, and they each placed an envelope in the casket, and they went back. Well, they were having lunch afterwards, and the pastor finally said, I have a confession to make. I didn't put the full $200,000 in that envelope. I took $40,000 out $20,000 out as a tithe because I knew that our good friend Mrs. Murphy would have wanted that to go to the Christian education wing of the church she was so fond of." And the doctor said, "Well, I have a confession to make too. You know, Mrs. Murphy died of cancer, and I knew that she wanted to benefit the cancer wing, and so I took $40,000 out of the envelope and donated it to the Cancer Society." And the lawyer said, "I just can't believe you guys. This was our dear friend and our client, and she entrusted us with this money. And I want you to know that my check for $200,000 was in that envelope." And if you're not a lawyer and you can't laugh at yourself, then, you know, what is it? One of the things that I want to start talking about today is the idea of leaving a legacy instead of an inheritance for our family and our kids. We live in unusual times today, maybe that previous generations haven't seen. We're through the variety of different assets we have, we're literally worth a lot more dead than we are alive. And so planning becomes a very important process because, as we all know, there's no U-Hauls behind hearses. And so we can't take it with us in that perspective. So I want to give you a couple of examples. And I call this, I'm thinking about writing a book. If I could just get my clicker to work. Let's see. I may have to do this by hand. Left Behind. Maybe I can get one of you guys, Steve, if you could, that's the clicker there, and I'll just give you the high sign, and we'll go for, I don't know what's wrong with the technology. I heard that someone else had the title of that book, but I thought I'd use it because this would be the chilling story of what can happen to your children and your estate after your death. As a lawyer, I get to hear a lot of interesting stories, and one is about the son that gets a divorce and the ex-daughter-in-law that winds up with the inheritance, or worse, her new husband. Your daughter, who runs into financial problems and her inheritance is taken away by creditors, thieves, or worse, the IRS. A son's business which fails, and the inheritance that you leave to them for the benefit of your grandchildren goes to the bankruptcy trustee. Your daughter is financially immature and invests her inheritance in bad investments or gives it to her newfound friends, Joe Neiman and Harry Marcus. Or probably what's more of an issue is that your son, when he receives his inheritance, drops out of school or quits his job because of that new inheritance and lives off the inheritance until it's gone, and then he has to start all over again. And there's no father to welcome him back with a robe and a ring, if you catch my drift. I want to give you some inheritance facts. The first one is 50% of the children who receive an inheritance this year will spend it within 6 months. 80% of the children that receive an inheritance this year will spend it within 1 year. The average length of time before a major purchase, 16 days. Does the term easy come, easy go ring a bell here? And finally, the divorce rate goes way up following an inheritance. Now, one of the things you look at this and you say, well, that sounds like what happens to people who win the lottery. Bingo. I mean, if you stop and think about it, isn't that somewhat what we're beginning to set up for our children? Just in your mind or on your little piece of, on a piece of paper there, take a minute and jot down what the rough equivalent value of your estate might be if you were to die tomorrow. In there, you might think about the value of real estate that you have, your home, and this would be you and your spouse, your wife too. Any insurance that you might have, any investments, your retirement proceeds, personal property items, any business interests that you may have. When you kind of get a number in your mind then, think about the way most of us have written our estate documents. Generally, it's everything to my wife if I die, and then if both of us die, we divide it equally to our children, and they get that inheritance outright. If you look down at that number that you've got there, and you find that what your children will be receiving will be equal to or greater than 1 year of their annual income, then you're giving them a major inheritance. And you're giving them an inheritance that could ultimately change the way that they deal with finances. Now, this isn't true for everybody, but it's a good exercise to begin to go through. This is kind of what I call the evangelism explosion method of estate planning. If you died tomorrow, where would things go? Do you know where your estate would go? I want to give you a next slide here. This is something that I took out of a newspaper in Boise, Idaho. It's called Donald Gets a Second Chance. Boise, Idaho, Donald Roberts walked out from a wilderness area near Stanley on January 30th, months after he was given up for dead. He said that he hurt himself while hunting and decided to stay put in a rugged wilderness area. Roberts was missing for 85 days. Two different courts declared Roberts legally dead. A life insurance company was just about ready to pay off the mortgage on his home. A dispute had arisen between his business partners and his family over the estate's share of the company. His relatives were quarreling over his possessions. Mr. Roberts had a unique experience that is source familiar with the bickering that usually accompanies a probate case when there is no will. He's probably one of the few people in history who's had the opportunity to personally observe what happens to his property and debts, what happens among his remaining friends and relatives when he dies. There's a little bit of a misnomer because we think that if you haven't written a will, then you don't have a will. But actually, the state has written a will for you. And so the choice is not really, do you want to have a will or not? Everyone has a will. The question is, do you want the will that the state has written for you? And so I've got a sample of the will. And actually, what's interesting is before I moved to Colorado, I went to law school in Oklahoma, so my original William Moore will was written according to Oklahoma law, so if you're from Oklahoma, you can appreciate this. This is the last will and testament of William Woe. I, William Woe, of Colorado Springs, Colorado, being of sound mind, hereby do make and publish and declare this to be my last will and testament. I have complete confidence in the state in which I now reside and equal confidence in the courts. Therefore, should my wife and I both die while my children are minors, the court can appoint a guardian to manage their affairs. A stranger would be acceptable, for I have no opinion as to who would best care for my children. Because of my confidence in the state, I authorize them to determine what property of mine my wife should get and what property my children should get. I understand and agree that it should be split one half for my wife and one half for my children. As a safeguard of my estate, I require that my wife make an annual accounting of how and why she spent the money necessary for the proper care of our children. When my children reach the age of 18, they can do whatever they please with their share of my estate. My wife shall give a complete written account of everything that she's done up to that point with that child's money. Because the government has needs for money which are greater than the needs of my wife and children, it's probably true nowadays, I direct that no attempt be made to lower my estate and other taxes or probate expenses. William Moe. So if that will works for you, then you can probably sit back and take it easy here, because most of the things I have to say won't be of direct relationship. So there are times also. Oh, we're already up here. Oh, you're quick. Okay, this is my wheel illustration, and of course I wouldn't be a very good navigator if I didn't have a wheel illustration. But in that process, then, there's really more areas to estate planning when we think about it than just a will and a trust. We also have instructions and advisors. Leaving a notebook or something that contains all the important documents, that copies of the important documents, who are you the advisors that advise you in various areas, and who are and what instructions would you like to see done? Healthcare forms. These are medical durable power of attorney. These actually would become more important during your life than even the will, obviously, since it comes into play at death. But part of this process usually is to get those health care forms, which allow you to designate another person to make a medical decision for you in the event you can't make one for yourself. Property ownership is another key element, because if I was to poll this room, I think we would find that probably 75% of the assets that we own will not pass underneath our will directly. They pass in other ways. If I own a piece of property in joint tenancy with my wife, then by law that passes to my wife at death. It doesn't pass underneath my will. Now that normally becomes that's a pretty good deal normally, but it can be a different situation when we have second marriages or situations like that. The other thing is retirement plans, insurance products, and annuity forms are all contract assets. You designate on that contract who you want to have the proceeds paid to. And even though you designate in my will, I want my retirement plan to go to my wife or my children, it will go to whomever you've designated in that contract arrangement. So when we think about real estate in joint tenancy, or assets in joint tenancy, and assets by contract, we're probably talking, or we could be talking about as much as 75% of the value of the assets that you have. So it's very important to kind of take a look at all those designations. One of the things that that we put out is a 21-point checklist for you to check through in terms of your estate. And I didn't bring any of those along, but if you contact headquarters, the State and Financial Planning Department, we'd be happy to send you that information. Incapacity is a power of attorney, and then of course charitable planning. No plan that was ever written has ever included a charity in it, written by the state. And so if you want to include charities, you need to do that. When do you consider more than a will these days? You've probably all heard of revocable living trusts and all the planning that's been done with revocable living trusts. Revocable trusts used to be only for the very wealthy, but we realized that with the revocable trust, you bypass the court process, the probate process, and you can also do some tax planning. But these are some of the issues that might arise. If any of these circumstances, or if you have any of these, if you can answer yes to any of these issues, that you have a total of estate value of $500,000 or more, if your property is in more than one state, then you'd have to probate in every state. Previous marriages or support obligations also require a more disciplined approach to your planning. If you have a child with a disability, disability creates the opportunity for Social Security benefits and other kinds of medical benefits that you can basically cut your child off from with an inheritance. And so there's ways to structure that in your estate plan so that you provide for that child without creating a problem for their medical benefits. Non-U.S. citizen, there's some limitations on what you can leave there. If your spouse is a non-U.S. citizen, closely held businesses, those are always tricky to work with. And then potential conflict over an asset, that would be, if you can imagine, if anybody might fight over your estate. Yeah.
How did you arrive at the amount of
$500,000? I did that because normally at $500,000 you start to get issues regarding management in the event of your death. In other words, who would help my wife manage things, and if she would become disabled temporarily, who would step in to help pay the bills and make sure that investments are made? And so, generally, it's very rough. There's nothing, there's no tax consequences that occur at $500,000 anymore. But as long as we're dealing with trusts, I got a little bag of tricks here. Okay. Every state that you own property in, if you have a will, you must probate it in that state. We had a case where we had a client that owned 29 pieces of property in 26 different states. When we did the probate, and he died with a will, just a will, when we did the probate on that state, it looked like a lawyer's convention because we had 26 different lawyers in there because of the, and so... it seems like a small thing, and particularly when you have people in the military, who've moved one place or another, you can own property in more than one state, or if you inherit part of a farm. So that's where that comes in. Well, let me just talk to you a little bit about trusts here, because trusts, partnerships, things like that. Why do we do things? Why do we have entities like trusts and partnerships? You probably have asked yourself that question. Well. We think of ownership of assets as being one thing. Well, I own something, and so I have my rights to ownership. But ownership under the law is a bundle of rights. It's really a variety of different rights that we have. If I own something, it's like this bundle of sticks. If I own something, I get to control it. I can tell people, I can control what's done with that property. If I own something, I get to benefit from it. I can derive what benefit comes from that property. And finally, if I own something, I get it titled in my name. It's titled in my name. What we do with trusts, corporations, and partnerships is that enables us to split up these rights and to put them with different people. Because ownership, that bundle, normally comes as a complete package. If I was to ask you which of these three things are most important, what would you tell me?
All of them.
All of them are important. But which is the most important? Well, we've got a nice mix here. I would argue that control is the most important. And control would be the most important because if I control an asset, I can choose who benefits from it. I'm sure most of you are fathers in here, and you control your estate, but you know who benefits from it. If I was to choose one that would be the least valuable, it would be title. And why would that be? One, because liability follows title, and taxes follow title. And that's why I used a plunger handle to... and that's why you kind of see what this end is. Very appropriate. But the idea is, when you start to think of it in terms of why we use these things, with a corporation, we put title in the name of the corporation, we have directors who control it, we have shareholders who benefit. They can be the same people or they can be different people. When we have a trust, the trust has title to assets, we have trustees that control everything, and then we have beneficiaries who benefit. And with a partnership, we have partnership that owns title, we have general partners who control, and we have limited partners or total partners that benefit. And so it's just helpful to understand, why do we use these legal elements to do things? Well, we do it so we can break up the aspects of ownership so that we can put one piece in one entity and one piece in another entity.
Bill, I understand that one property right is the right of investiture. That would that be associated with title or control?
It would probably be more associated with control, because you then have the right to designate where that goes and ultimately what the disposition is going to be.
Okay.
If you determine you need to set up a trust, do you also need a will?
Yes. Two important things with a will. One is guardians are designated by will, and so if you have minor children, that's important. But the second thing is that we use what's called a pour-over will, which means that the will pours into the trust at your death any assets that may be in your name at death. And that's an important aspect because you never know. You may not get something into your trust. What we want to do with a living trust is want everything titled in the name of that trust so that it operates and a trust doesn't die, so it doesn't go through the probate process. But if you don't have something in trust, then the pour-over will puts it in, or you could have a situation where, let's say, you died in an automobile accident. There were proceeds that went to you. Well, those proceeds would go to your estate, and then you'd want them put into the trust for the benefit. But we can do some longer-term planning with the trust. Yeah.
You have a trust, and you have a property that's not put in the trust.
Then it will pass under the will to the trust, but it goes through probate on the way to the trust.
Yeah. Sounds like even if you have a small stake, it's still good to have a trust.
It's getting to be that place. You know, it used to be that it was only multi-million-dollar estates that utilized the trust, and then we said, well, you know, it makes sense for other people. And then now, as we're getting down, you start to look at these things, you say, you know, it's not a bad plan for almost everybody. And I would say, first of all, if you have minor children, you need a trust. I mean, that's just now that trust can be in your will or it can be in a separate trust. But yeah, the revocable living trust, as the price is coming down for those things and they're becoming more and more common, they become more and more valuable for everybody. I'm going to kind of go through slides. As you probably are aware, the new tax act changed our estate tax exemption, and so no longer are we snuffling by with just a $675,000 individual exemption, but now we're up to $1 million, and this eventually goes to repeal in 2010. Now, it makes for some interesting planning as we go forward, as you kind of see. This is an individual estate tax exemption. And so through trust planning, we can also utilize a husband's estate tax exemption and a wife's estate tax exemption. And so you can double these numbers with proper planning and still not have an estate issue. But as you can see, when we get down here to 2010, then everything's repealed. Then it jumps back to $1 million at 2011. And so we've developed a new planning technique in case you have a relative or you personally die in the next 8 years. If you have a large freezer, we think we can keep you alive until 2010. And that way your family can benefit. But what we're also finding is a lot of people are kind of wanting to put a provision in their will and trust that if I should die mysteriously in the year 2010, then my children don't receive anything. To give you some idea of this probate process that we talked about, you can see these are kind of minimal fees that are charged. You can usually look at it and think about 5% of the estate. The Bar Association wouldn't care for me telling you these things because this is the way a lot of lawyers retire. You write a good will and then you wait for the probates to start coming in. But anyway, this gives you some idea of how that process works. I want to move through an estate here to kind of show you how things might work from a tax standpoint. First is... Okay, we have a couple. They're getting ready to retire. They have a home that's worth about $325,000. They have a rental house in California, half an interest in a farm that was left to them by their parents in Iowa, various investments that they've accumulated, a retirement plan of about $500,000, personal property worth $50,000, and a life insurance policy of $500,000. You can kind of think about that in terms of your estate. Total estate of $2,025,000. $1,000. Now, according to the state tax designations that you saw earlier, we've got technically no tax, right? And that's what people might look at it and see. Next slide. Okay. So we take that gross estate of $2 million, and we have the first spouse die, and both of them have simple wills, which means everything when I die goes to my wife, and everything my wife dies goes to my kids. Okay, next. At that first spouse's death, there's just a small probate expense fee because everything is held in joint tenancy, and it's a pretty simple passing. It takes a tax return, but that's it. Then what happens when the second spouse dies? Well, we have probate expenses that have significantly risen because now we've got the whole $2 million to deal with coming out of her estate. And because we haven't separated it out, everything went into her estate under the unlimited marital deduction, but now the full $2 million is subject to estate tax. And so, where according to our system, we could have gotten by without any taxes, there's now a $345,000 tax, estate tax. But what about the income tax? You say, well, income tax, there's no income tax on estates, but there's income tax on retirement plans. And so we haven't considered that. So there, remember, there was a $500,000 retirement plan. What we're seeing is that more and more people are getting larger and larger retirement plans. And what happens is you don't spend that down as quickly because why? Well, I get ordinary income tax when it's taken out. And so we cause that to accumulate. Well, that rolls forward. And so what we see here is we got total taxes and expenses of about $600,000 on our $2 million estate. And so that nets to the year about $1.4 million.
Bill, is there a way for your kids to keep that in the 401k when the second spouse dies?
What happens is you, not in the 401k, but you can roll it into an IRA, and then you can do stretch IRAs.
That way. Mm-hmm. And if you did, you would escape that for the time being.
Yeah. But So it rolls forward. But you see, you've got an automatic estate shrinkage of about 30% without some additional planning. And that's on an estate with a variety of different kinds of assets as we go through. So anyway, that gives you a little bit of a perspective of the context that we're going to be dealing in. Now, as we start to look at what it is that we want our kids to have and what we're trying to grow up in these kids, I want to look at some biblical verses first.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say one thing too on the probate business. You don't put in time because it can take a year or two or more.
Absolutely.
This thing is all tied up, and really the lawyer thing can be a lot higher because of time.
Yeah, that's so, absolutely true.
I've talked to people that their estate was tied up for 2-3 years, and they got no benefit until it went through there, and they lost 50-60% of it by the time the thing really got churned up.
So. Yeah, and that's a very good point. Is we don't consider the time delay that can occur at death, because it can really, at a time when perhaps people need it the most, you have things locked up in dispute. But I want to focus now, and we could talk, you can grab me individually during the conference to talk about if you have an individual issue regarding your estate, but I want to talk a little bit about what inheritance and what we can do with that and what we're trying to build up in our kids as well. Psalm 37:11 says, "But the meek will inherit the land." Psalm 37:29, "The righteous will inherit the land." Of course, Matthew 5:5 says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." What I'd like to propose is that character seems to matter in the Bible with respect to inheritance. Too often I see people that just say, well, I'm going to leave everything to my kids. And what I hear behind those words are, well, I didn't do a very good job of raising them, or I didn't spend time with them when I should have, or I didn't instill the values I would have liked to, and so I'm going to make everything better by putting some money on it at the end. Well, by treating them the same in that context. And, it talks about meekness here. That's okay. Numbers 12:3 says that Moses was the meekest man that ever lived. And so it's not just humbleness as we think of milk toast, but it's really being open to what God has for us. And then the second thing, Matthew 19:29, "And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life." And so, to me, as I look at it, I think the Christian service matters. And so the people that are willing to give up on that standpoint are worthy of an inheritance. Next area. Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as reward. And so, I think that your work matters to God, whatever that work may be. And next thing, the two parables of the talents and the minas. If you remember, that was a situation where the Lord rewarded, gave the servants parables or minas and told them to invest it, and they invested it well. And when the Lord returned, they gave them that return. And so I think that responsibility and stewardship matters to the Lord, and that's an important issue. Matters, yeah. I haven't quite figured out this PowerPoint thing, you know. Revelation 21:7. That's why I can't use the clicker. He who overcomes will inherit all this. Eight times in Revelation 21 it talks about the overcomers. And so, consequently, I think that a godly life matters probably to God. Well, you never hear. Godly life matters. And then Proverbs 13:22. This is probably the most common verse that I hear on inheritance. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. I want you to think about that a little bit. Is why would that be? Why not for children instead of children's children? As we tend to think of inheritance for our own children, and I'll cover that in just a minute. And the last one is So I think future generations matter. And then the last one is wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of the possessor. What's important? What is important? Yeah, okay. Okay, next to pass. Okay, what do we owe our children? And that's something that we stop and think about. I'm going to give you the perspective of some famous people, and then you can go from there. Bill Gates said this, "I won't leave a lot of money to my heirs because I don't think it would be good for them." When asked why he never chooses to fly first class on any of his flights, he said, "I don't want to get used to it." Maybe the Enron guys should have looked. Warren Buffett said this, "Parents should leave children enough money so that they would feel they could do anything, but not so much that they could do nothing." T. Boone Pickens said this, "Having one's work effort recognized by peers builds self-esteem. If you don't watch out, you can set up a situation where a child never has the pleasure of bringing home a paycheck." Gordon Moore of Intel said, "Children ought to have a sense of accomplishment for what they have done." George Bush the Senior said, "Together we can show that what really matters in the end are not possessions." And that was part of his 1,000 Points of Light campaign. And then finally, from the book Teaching Children Joy, Richard and Linda Erie said, "A family should be an institution. A family should not be individuals grouped together for convenience, where children live until they can be on their own." And some of us think having children on their own might be a good thing eventually, but it is. I have a friend who said that he put a sign above his door and said, "Check out is 21 years of age." But we struggle with the myth of the American dream, that, and even though we don't necessarily intellectually embrace it, we still live a lot of our life as if this is true, that money can, does, and should guarantee happiness in some form. And if we don't believe that, then why do we think that that will be different for our children? Many of us kind of indirectly agree with George Bernard Shaw when he says, "I've been poor and I've been rich, and I like rich better." But one of the things that as we do, as we look at some of the research on what has made successful people over the last 50 years, you know, kind of the books that have come out, The Millionaire Next Door and The Millionaire Mind and other kinds of things like that, we find that the people who have been successful, 80% of the people who have become millionaires or successful financially in the last 50 years are first generation. And in the legal profession, we have story of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. You have one generation that makes money and establishes the estate, the next generation spends it, and then the third generation has to make it again. And so what we want to do is to try to think of the things that we can encourage in our children and really now encourage in our grandchildren. And my perspective's changed a lot because I now have children who are older and are beginning to marry and looking at having grandchildren. I'm looking ahead and saying, affecting grandchildren didn't seem to be nearly as important to me as it is now. But it's kind of the opportunity to start over, to provide some influence. And so what are the top 10 factors for success? One of the things, let me touch briefly on the goal here. Our goal really for our kids is to, for our sons and daughters, is that they grow into mature and independent, godly adults who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, who will face good and difficult times with calmness and perseverance, and who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents. Nothing really deals particularly with money in that, does it? But you can use money and your estate and your influence as a source to get to these ends. I've given you, one of the sheets that I've given you is a list of 30 different factors. And if we had more time, what I would do is I'd have us all fill out those factors, and I'd want you to list the top 10 things that you think are most important in terms of success factors that you've found in your life. And you can do this exercise later on your own. This list came about by way of they interviewed 900 successful people who had been successful in life, and they came up with 100 different values or factors. From that 100, these are the top 30. And like I said, if we had a little more time, we could all work on what would be our top 10. But I'm going to give you what they found. They found were their top 10. Top 10 success: being honest with all people, being well disciplined, getting along with most people. Number 4, having a supportive spouse. Number 5, working harder than most people. Number 6, loving my career or business. 7, having strong leadership qualities. 8, having a very competitive spirit or personality. 9, being well organized. And 10, having an ability to sell my ideas or my products. Now, when you look at this, this is not what the press would call success factors for corporate America today, is it? You know, they would say that people got to the top by being dishonest and by cheating, and that you know we do whatever we want when we want to do it, so not well disciplined. So it's kind of interesting that really some of these things, and if I was to throw in one of the next ones, which is a spiritual component, you know, you probably would find that you would list somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 or 6 of these things. And so, let's see what the next slide. They fall into these main categories. Most important is integrity and moral values. Next thing is social skills. Orientation toward criticism, creative intelligence, discipline versus luck, investing wisely, and intellectual orientation. So the keys to success, as I've kind of pulled them out, develop courage. And courage these days is really the courage to be successful. It means willing to take a risk with your ideas and your plans to go ahead regardless of what area that is in ministry or business or opportunities, to dwell on your successes rather than your failures, to believe in hard work and to believe in yourself in that process, and to believe that God can give you and the ability to create and to provide for your family. Means to organize yourself. Nearly 40% of the 900 successful people had listed religious faith and strong religious faith as a primary component. The next thing is select a vocation that you love. As you encourage your children and your grandchildren, encourage them to find things that they really love and vocations that they value. Not doing something just because you can make money at it or something to do 9 to 5. And as you think back on your own life, isn't that what, you know, we wish maybe we had done? Or even those of us nowadays, that seemed to be more important before. And a lot of us do have vocations that we really enjoy or love. But so often today, people are driven by other things. And so that's an important correlation to success in life. Next area. Find a good mate. 85% of the people that were successful had been married more than 20 years. Spouses have an unusually high degree of impact on your success. And I'm probably preaching to the choir here in that sense. But do we think about that in terms of our kids? And how important it is to encourage our kids to choose a spouse that will be a good mate for life. Because that can have a tremendous impact on their happiness, their success, and their ability to benefit their family. Good advisors and mentors, which pretty appropriate for this conference. Bear Bryant put it this way, and Bear Bryant, when he would bring in a new class of recruits to the University of Alabama, he'd gather them together and he'd say, "Now, y'all, the first thing I want you to do is go back to your dorm room and call your parents and thank them, because nobody gets to this level without help from other people." And that's really the key, is nobody gets to be successful, particularly in our world today, without help from other people, without a variety of help. And so it's very important to encourage children and grandchildren, even younger people that we work with, to find good mentors and advisors. Because you can't get it all, you can't know it all in that process. Handle criticism. It's kind of a different approach, but they found that successful people either know how to ignore critics, or they know how to use criticism to stimulate them, to encourage them, and to drive them on. And we all know people who said, you know, when their third grade teacher said, "You'll never amount to anything, by golly, I was going to make something of myself." Think for yourself. This is kind of a creative aspect. People who get ahead learn how to think creatively, learn how to think for themselves, take chances on what they think. And this is something we encourage. I came, before I was a lawyer, I was a teacher. And I even taught preschool. But I taught teachers for a while at the university level. And what the research says is that you have to encourage a child who has had a negative home life, you have to encourage them 11 times more often than you do a child from a successful. Important to kind of take a look at all those designations. One of the things that we put out is a 21-point checklist for you to check through in terms of your estate. And I didn't bring any of those along, but if you contact headquarters, the State and Financial Planning Department, we'd be happy to send you that information. Incapacity is a power of attorney, and then of course charitable planning. No plan that was ever written has ever included a charity in it, written by the state. And so if you want to include charities, you need to do that. When do you consider more than a will these days? You probably all heard of revocable living trusts and all the planning that's been done with revocable living trusts. Revocable trusts used to be only for the very wealthy. But we realize that with the revocable trust, you bypass the court process, the probate process, and you can also do some tax planning. But these are some of the issues that might arise. If any of these circumstances, or if you have any of these, if you can answer yes to any of these issues, that you have a total of estate value of $500,000 or more, if your property is in more than one state, then you'd have to probate in every state. Previous marriages or support obligations also require a more disciplined approach to your planning. If you have a child with a disability, disability creates the opportunity for Social Security benefits and other kinds of medical benefits that you can basically cut your child off from with an inheritance. And so there's ways to structure that in your estate plan so that you provide for that child without creating a problem for their medical benefits. Non-U.S. citizen, there's some limitations on what you can leave there. If your spouse is a non-U.S. citizen, closely held businesses, those are always tricky to work with. And then potential conflict over an asset, that would be, if you can imagine, if anybody might fight over your estate. Yeah.
How did you arrive at the amount of
$500,000? I did that because normally at $500,000 you start to get issues regarding management in the event of your death. In other words, who would help my wife manage things? And if she would become disabled temporarily, who would step in to help pay the bills and make sure that investments are made? And so generally it's very rough. There's nothing, there's no tax consequences that occur at $500,000 anymore. But as long as we're dealing with trusts, I got a little bag of tricks here. Yeah.
How about property in more than one state? What's that?
Okay. Every state that you own property in, if you have a will, you must probate it in that state. We had a case where we had a client that owned 29 pieces of property in 26 different states. When we did the probate, and he died with a will, just a will. When we did the probate on that state, it looked like a lawyer's convention, because we had 26 different lawyers in there because of the, and so it seems like a small thing, and particularly when you have people in the military, or other, who've moved one place or another, you can own property in more than one state, or if you inherit part of a farm. So that's where that comes in. But let me just talk to you a little bit about trusts here. Because trusts, partnerships, things like that. Why do we do things? Why do we have entities like trusts and partnerships? You probably have asked yourself that question. Well, we think of ownership of assets as being one thing. Well, I own something, and so I have my rights to ownership. But ownership under the law is a bundle of rights. It's really a variety of different rights that we have. If I own something, it's like this bundle of sticks. If I own something, I get to control it. I can tell people, I can control what's done with that property. If I own something, I get to benefit from it. I can derive what benefit comes from that property. And finally, if I own something, I get it titled in my name. It's titled in my name. What we do with trusts, corporations, and partnerships is that enables us to split up these rights and to put them with different people. Because ownership, that bundle, normally comes as a complete package. If I was to ask you which of these three things are most important, what would you tell me?
All of them.
All of them are important. But which is the most important?
The right of
property. Well, we've got a nice mix here. I would argue that control is the most important. And control would be the most important because if I control an asset, I can choose who benefits from it. I'm sure most of you are fathers in here, and you control your estate, but you know who benefits from it. If I was to choose one that would be the least valuable, it would be title. And why would that be? One, because liability follows title, and taxes follow title. And that's why I used a plunger handle to. And that's why you kind of see what this end is. Very appropriate. But the idea is, when you start to think of it in terms of why we use these things, with a corporation, we put title in the name of the corporation. We have directors who control it. We have shareholders who benefit. They can be the same people or they can be different people. When we have a trust, we have the trust has title to assets. We have trustees that control everything. And then we have beneficiaries who benefit. And with a partnership, we have partnership that owns title. We have general partners who control. And we have limited partners or total partners that benefit. And so it's just helpful to understand, why do we use these legal elements to do things? Well, we do it so we can break up the aspects of ownership so that we can put one piece in one entity and one piece in another entity.
Bill, understand that one property right is the right of investiture. Does that fall, would that be associated with title or control?
It would probably be more associated with control, because you then have the right to designate where that goes and ultimately what the disposition is going to be.
If you determine you need to set up a trust, do you also need a will?
Yes. Two important things with a will. One is guardians are designated by will, and so if you have minor children, that's important. But the second thing is that we use what's called a pour-over will, which means that the will pours into the trust at your death any assets that may be in your name at death. And that's an important aspect, because you never know. You may not get something into your trust. What we want to do with a living trust is want everything titled in the name of that trust so that it operates and a trust doesn't die, so it doesn't go through the probate process. But if you don't have something in trust, then the pour-over will puts it in, or you could have a situation where, let's say, you died in an automobile accident. There were proceeds that went to you. Well, those proceeds would go to your estate, and then you'd want them put into the trust for the benefit. But we can do some longer-term planning with the trust. Yeah.
You have a trust, and you have property that's not put in the trust. What happens to it?
Then it will pass under the will to the trust, but it goes through probate on the way to the trust.
Yeah. Sounds like even if you have a small stake, it's still good to have a trust.
It's getting to be that place. You know, it used to be that it was only multi-million-dollar estates that utilized the trusts. And then we said, well, you know, it makes sense for other people. And then now, as we're getting down, you start to look at these things, you say, you know, it's not a bad plan for almost everybody. And I would say, first of all, if you have minor children, you need a trust. I mean, that's just now that trust can be in your will or it can be a separate trust. But yeah, the revocable living trust, as the price is coming down for those things and they're becoming more and more common, they become more and more valuable for everybody. I'm going to kind of go through slides. As you probably are aware, the new tax act changed our estate tax exemption, and so no longer are we snuffling by with just a $675,000 individual exemption, but now we're up to $1 million, and this eventually goes to repeal in 2010. Now, it makes for some interesting planning as we go forward, as you kind of see. This is an individual estate tax exemption, and so through trust planning, we can also utilize a husband's estate tax exemption and a wife's estate tax exemption. And so you can double these numbers with proper planning and still not have an estate issue. But as you can see, when we get down here to 2010, then everything's repealed. Then it jumps back to $1 million at 2011. And so we've developed a new planning technique in case you have a relative or you personally die in the next 8 years. If you have a large freezer, we think we can keep you alive until 2010. And that way your estate your family can benefit. But what we're also finding is a lot of people are kind of wanting to put a provision in their will and trust that if I should die mysteriously in the year 2010, then my children don't receive anything. To give you some idea of this probate process that we talked about, you can see these are kind of minimal fees that are charged. You can usually look at it and think about 5% of the estate. The Bar Association wouldn't care for me telling you these things, because this is the way a lot of lawyers retire. You write a good will and then you wait for the probates to start coming in. But anyway, this gives you some idea of how that process works. I want to move through an estate here to kind of show you how things might work from a tax standpoint. First is, we have a couple. They're getting ready to retire. They have a home that's worth about $325,000. They have a rental house in California, half an interest in a farm that was left to them by their parents in Iowa, various investments that they've accumulated, a retirement plan of about $500,000, personal property worth $50,000, and a life insurance policy of $500,000. You can kind of think about that in terms of your estate. Total estate of $2,025,000. Now, according to the state tax designations that you saw earlier, we've got technically no tax, right? And that's what people might look at it and see. Next slide. Okay. So we take that gross estate of $2 million, and we have the first spouse die, and both of them have simple wills, which means everything when I die goes to my wife, and everything when my wife dies goes to my kids. Okay. Next. At that first spouse death, there's just a small probate expense fee because everything is held in joint tenancy, and it's a pretty simple passing. It takes a tax return, but that's it. Then what happens when the second spouse dies? Well, we have probate and expenses that have significantly risen because now we've got the whole $2 million to deal with coming out of her estate. And because we haven't separated it out, everything went into her estate under the unlimited marital deduction, but now the full $2 million is subject to estate tax. And so where, according to our system, we could have gotten by without any taxes, there's now a $345,000 tax, estate tax. But what about the income tax? You say, well, income tax, there's no income tax on estates, but there's income tax on retirement plans. And so we haven't considered that. So remember, there was a $500,000 retirement plan. What we're seeing is that more and more people are getting larger and larger retirement plans. And what happens is you don't spend that down as quickly because why? Well, I get ordinary income tax when it's taken out. And so we cause that to accumulate. Well, that rolls forward. And so what we see here is we've got total taxes and expenses of about $600,000, our $2 million estate. And so that nets to the year about $1.4 million.
Is there a way for your kids to keep that in the 401k when the second spouse dies?
What happens is you, not in the 401k, but you can roll it into an IRA, and then you can do stretch IRAs.
That way. Mm-hmm. And if you did, you would escape that for the time being.
Yeah. But. So it rolls forward. But you see, you've got an automatic estate shrinkage of about 30% without some additional planning. And that's, that's on an estate with a variety of different kinds of assets as we go through. So anyway, that gives you a little bit of a perspective of the context that we're going to be dealing in. Now, as we start to look at what it is that we want our kids to have and what we're trying to grow up in these kids, I want to look at some... biblical verses first.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say one thing too on the probate business. You don't put in time because it can take a year or two or more.
Absolutely.
This thing is all tied up, and really the lawyer thing can be a lot higher because of time.
Yeah, that's so, absolutely true.
I've talked to people that their estate was tied up for 2-3 years, and they got no benefit until it went through there, and mm-hmm. they lost 50-60% of it by the time the thing really got churned up.
So. Yeah, and that's a very good point. Is we don't consider the time delay that can occur at death, because it can really, at a time when perhaps people need it the most, you have things locked up in dispute. But I want to focus now, and we could talk, you can grab me individually during the conference to talk about if you have an individual issue regarding your estate, but I want to talk a little bit about what inheritance and what we can do with that and what we're trying to build up in our kids as well. Psalm 37:11 says, "But the meek will inherit the land." Psalm 37:29, "The righteous will inherit the land." Of course, Matthew 5:5 says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." What I'd like to propose is that character seems to matter in the Bible. with respect to inheritance. Too often I see people that just say, well, I'm going to leave everything to my kids. And what I hear behind those words are, well, I didn't do a very good job of raising them, or I didn't spend time with them when I should have, or I didn't instill the values I would have liked to, and so I'm going to make everything better by putting some money on it at the end, or by treating them the same in that context. And, you know, it talks about meekness here. That's okay. Numbers 12:3 says that Moses was the meekest man that ever lived. And so it's not just a humbleness as we think of milk toast, but it's really being open to what God has for us. And then the second thing, Matthew 19:29, and everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. And so, to me, as I look at it, I think the Christian service matters. And so the people that are willing to give up on that standpoint are worthy of an inheritance. Next area. Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as reward. And so I think that your work matters to God, whatever that work may be. And next thing, the two parables of the talents and the minas. If you remember, that was a situation where the Lord rewarded, gave the servants parables or minas and told them to invest it, and they invested it well, and when the Lord returned, they gave him that return. And so I think that responsibility and stewardship matters to the Lord, and that's an important issue. Matters, yeah. I haven't quite figured out this PowerPoint thing, you know. Revelation 21:7. That's why I can't use the clicker. He who overcomes will inherit all this. 8 times in Revelation 21 it talks about the overcomers. And so, consequently, I think that a godly life matters probably to God. Yep. Oh,
no.
Well, you never know. Godly life matters. And then Proverbs 13:22. This is probably the most common verse that I hear on inheritance. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. I want you to think about that a little bit. Is why would that be? Why not for children instead of children's children? Because we tend to think of inheritance for our own children. And I'll cover that in just a minute. The last one is, I think future generations matter. And then the last one is, wisdom like an inheritance is a good thing. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter, but the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of the possessor. What's important? What is important? Yeah, okay. Okay, next to pass. Okay, what do we owe our children? And that's something that we stop and think about. I'm going to give you the perspective of some famous people, and then you can go from there. Bill Gates said this, "I won't leave a lot of money to my heirs because I don't think it would be good for them." When asked why he never chooses to fly first class on any of his flights, he said, "I don't want to get used to it." Maybe the Enron guys should have. Warren Buffett said this, "Parents should leave children enough money so that they would feel they could do anything, but not so much that they could do nothing." T. Boone Pickens said this, "Having one's work effort recognized by peers builds self-esteem. If you don't watch out, you can set up a situation where a child never has the pleasure of bringing home a paycheck." Gordon Moore of Intel said, "Children ought to have a sense of accomplishment for what they have done." George Bush the Senior said, "Together we can show that what really matters in the end are not possessions." And that was part of his 1,000 Points of Light campaign. And then finally, from the book Teaching Children Joy, Richard and Linda Erie said, "A family should be an institution, A family should not be individuals grouped together for convenience, where children live until they can be on their own. And some of us think having children on their own might be a good thing eventually. But it is. I have a friend who said that he put a sign above his door and said, check out, his 21 years of age. But we struggle with the myth of the American dream, that, and even though we don't necessarily intellectually embrace it, we still live a lot of our life as if this is true, that money can, does, and should guarantee happiness in some form. And if we don't believe that, then why do we think that that will be different for our children? Many of us kind of indirectly agree with George Bernard Shaw when he says, I've been poor and I've been rich, and I like rich better. But one of the things that as we look at some of the research on what has made successful people over the last 50 years, you know, kind of the books that have come out, The Millionaire Next Door and The Millionaire Mind and other kinds of things like that, we find that the people who have been successful, 80% of the people who have become millionaires or successful financially in the last 50 years are first generation. And in the legal profession, we have story of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. You have one generation that makes money and establishes the estate, the next generation spends it, and then the third generation has to make it again. And so what we want to do is to try to think of the things that we can encourage in our children and really now encourage in our grandchildren. And my perspective's changed a lot because I now have children who are older and are beginning to marry and looking at having grandchildren. I'm looking ahead and saying, affecting grandchildren didn't seem to be nearly as important to me as it is now. But it's kind of the opportunity to start over, to provide some influence. And so what are the top 10 factors for success? One of the things, let me touch briefly on the goal here. Our goal really for our kids is for our sons and daughters, is that they grow into mature and independent, godly adults who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, who will face good and difficult times with calmness and perseverance, and who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents. Nothing really deals particularly with money in that, does it? But you can use money and your estate and your influence as a source to get to these ends. I've given you, one of the sheets that I've given you is a list of 30 different factors. And if we had more time, what I would do is I'd have us all fill out those factors, and I'd want you to list the top 10 things that you think are most important in terms of success factors that you've found in your life. And you can do this exercise later on your own. This list came about by way of, they interviewed 900 successful people who had been successful in life. And they came up with 100 different values or factors. From that 100, these are the top 30. And like I said, if we had a little more time, we could all work on what would be our top 10. But I'm going to give you what they found. Excuse me. They found were their top 10. Top 10 success: being honest with all people, being well disciplined, getting along with most people. Number 4, having a supportive spouse. Number 5, working harder than most people. Number 6. Loving my career or business. 7, having strong leadership qualities. 8, having a very competitive spirit or personality. 9, being well organized. And 10, having an ability to sell my ideas or my products. Now, when you look at this, this is not what the press would call success factors for corporate America today, is it? You know, they would say that people got to the top by being dishonest and by cheating, and that you know we do whatever we want when we want to do it. So not well disciplined. So it's kind of interesting that really some of these things, and if I was to throw in one of the next ones, which is a spiritual component, you know, you probably would find that you would list somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 or 6 of these things. And so, let's see what the next slide. They fall into these main categories. Most important is integrity and moral values. Next thing is social skills. Orientation toward criticism, creative intelligence, discipline versus luck, investing wisely, and intellectual orientation. So the keys to success, as I've kind of pulled them out, develop courage. And courage these days is really the courage to be successful. It means willing to take a risk with your ideas and your plans to go ahead, regardless of what area that is in ministry or business or opportunities, to dwell on your successes rather than your failures. To believe in hard work and to believe in yourself in that process and to believe that God can give you and the ability to create and to provide for your family. Means to organize yourself. Nearly 40% of the 900 successful people had listed religious faith and strong religious faith as a primary component. The next thing is select a vocation that you love. As you encourage your children and your grandchildren, encourage them to find things that they really love and vocations that they value. Not doing something just because you can make money at it or something to do 9 to 5. And as you think back on your own life, isn't that what we wish maybe we had done? Or even those of us nowadays... that seemed to be more important before, and a lot of us do have vocations that we really enjoy or love. But so often today, people are driven by other things. And so that's an important correlation to success in life. Next area. Find a good mate. 85% of the people that were successful had been married more than 20 years. Spouses have an unusually high degree of impact on your success. And I'm probably preaching to the choir here in that sense. But do we think about that in terms of our kids? And how important it is to encourage our kids to choose a spouse that will be a good mate for life. Because that can have a tremendous impact on their happiness, their success, and their ability to benefit their family. Good advisors and mentors, which pretty appropriate for this conference. Bear Bryant put it this way, and Bear Bryant, when he would bring in a new class of recruits to the University of Alabama, he'd gather them together and he'd say, "Now, y'all, the first thing I want you to do is go back to your dorm room and call your parents and thank them, because nobody gets to this level without help from other people." And that's really the key, is nobody gets to be successful, particularly in our world today, without help from other people, without a variety of help. And so it's very important to encourage children and grandchildren, even younger people that we work with, to find good mentors and advisors, because you can't get it all, you can't know it all in that process. Handle criticism. It's kind of a different approach, but they found that successful people either know how to ignore critics or they know how to use criticism to stimulate them, to encourage them, and to drive them on. And we all know people who said, when their third grade teacher said, "You'll never amount to anything, by golly, I was going to make something of myself." Think for yourself. This is kind of a creative aspect. People who get ahead... learn how to think creatively, learn how to think for themselves, take chances on what they think. And this is something we encourage. I came, before I was a lawyer, I was a teacher. And I even taught preschool. But I taught teachers for a while at the university level. And what the research says is that you have to encourage a child who has had a negative home life, you have to encourage them 11 times more often than you do a child from a successful situation. And this explains a lot of our behavior problems in the classroom, is that teachers are finding that they have to overly compliment kids just in order to get them to perform because of the negative experiences that they've had at home. And so you can imagine what kind of long-term effect that has. And it's just, you are making deposits into your children's self-esteem. And those deposits will come back later on in this form. Work hard. I don't think I have to explain that to anybody. And finally, value education. Education is a really interesting perspective here, because we think of education as, well, going to the best schools or getting good grades. And so we really want to push our kids and our grandchildren to be number one in their kid. I can still remember my mother every afternoon getting home and saying, "Were you the smartest kid in your class today?" And of course I was. But I never much felt like it in that sense. But what we're finding now is the research is telling us that the best students don't always make the most successful people in life, because we value different things in terms of expectations. We create an expectation for kids who do really well in school and say, these are going to be the successful kids, and they don't have to achieve in order to get that expectation. Whereas the other kids, the students that have to work hard to get their grades, are the ones who've learned the basic principles of hard work and will be able to succeed in whatever they do. Another thing they found is that it is not nearly as important to go to a very good school or to make extremely good grades as it is to finish school. And it is to finish, to feel good about the educational product that you have. And so when you think about your kids or your grandchildren going on for educational experiences, think about accomplishment of helping them achieve at their level and working hard and getting that, rather than pushing them into places that they don't fit because you think it might be a better educational experience. Let's see. Yeah, live below your means. And I wish I'd learned that one 25 years ago. You know, if there's one thing that I could pass on to my kids today, it would be how important that is in terms of your process. Whatever level you're at, if you live below your means, you will always be okay. This is kind of an interesting point that I want you to think in terms of also with respect to inheritance. Remember, we talked about the size of inheritance that people receive. Successful people who make their own wealth tend to invest in private investments or in startup companies. Successful people, in other words, people who are successful financially with money that they've inherited, their wealth tends to be in public investments like stocks and bonds. What that means is that if you are a wealth producer, you're a business entrepreneur, and when you invest in things that you understand and you know, then those things prosper. If you're a business owner and you're an entrepreneur and you invest in large companies or in stocks and bonds, you tend to get frustrated because, you can't control it. You can't see what's going on. You don't know it. You know, what are they doing over there with that money? But kids who inherit money who haven't earned it themselves really do better at maintaining that money if they get a good financial advisor who helps them. And that will keep the inheritance. And so this is kind of my financial planning illustration here. This is the guy that says, "I reviewed your financial picture, and if we manage your property well, there should be plenty for both of us." And at first I used to laugh and think that was a joke, and more and more, especially after the last year and a half, I think, I'd like to have that guy, you know? I'd like to have a guy who's still making money for me and for him, even at that point in time. So again, it goes back to finding good advisors. And so if you're going to leave an inheritance amount of money to children who have not had experience making money or investing it, you might want to leave an advisor along with that money in that process. Taking a long-term rather than a short-term perspective. Give you an illustration here. This is my fishing pole. I got a fish in there somewhere. All right. Somebody took my fish. Okay. You know, the idea that if you give a child a fish, he can eat for a day. If you give him a fishing pole, then he could eat for the rest of his life. Or, as I like to say, if you give a child a fishing pole, he'll hit his little brother over the head with it. But anyway, the idea is we take a longer-term perspective with our assets than simply dropping them off directly to kids. We try to give them a fishing pole rather than a fish. Many of you are involved in businesses, or you owned a business at one time or another. You know that when you go to invest in a business, you don't want to invest in a company that's borrowing money to make operational payments. In other words, if they're borrowing money to make payroll or to pay operational expenses, then pretty soon that company's not going to be around very long because they're spending more than they're making. When we invest in things, we want to invest in capital assets. And so when we give to children, if we give an inheritance outright, we're going to give an operational subsidy to those kids that will last for a period of time. And so we want to think about giving a capital asset. To give you an idea, this is a capital asset. See? The capital asset, because if you keep this chicken healthy, this chicken will lay eggs for you for a long time. This is a consumable asset. Same chicken, one meal. So you get an idea in that process. This is what we do so often with the inheritances that we leave, is we leave the chicken dinner instead of the chicken. And you'd think that people with money would have a better perspective on this. But I think it's been about 8 years ago now, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis died. You may remember that. She left an estate of about $20 million. In her estate, she had something called a charitable lead trust, which paid income to charity for a period of years, and then the assets went to her children. Because of the way that charitable lead trust was structured, and you can structure this way, there was no estate tax that would have been due on that $20 million. But the children had the ability, and they would have gotten the full value of the estate 15 years later. The children had the ability to circumvent that and to not choose to fund the charitable trust. And what they did is what so many kids today do, and they said, instead of, oh, that sounds like a good idea, I will perpetuate all of mom's money, they said, show me the money, and they took everything all at once. Well, they paid the tax on that, and so the $20 million or the $10 million each was cut down by 40%. Or actually more than that, about 50%, because of the estate tax then was at a 55% rate, graduated rate. Well, you may recall what happened 3 years later. John Kennedy, flying a plane with his wife, his only heir, direct heir, goes down. And so now what happens to that inheritance? Well, it goes back through the probate mechanism one more, probate and estate tax situation one more time. What 5 years earlier had been a $10 million inheritance that could have been a $10 million inheritance flowing forward using the charitable instruments at John's death was worth $2 million. And that's assuming that he didn't have any Enron stock. Which is probably not a very good assumption these days. But anyway, that gives you some idea of what we're looking at here. And even wise kids who should know better don't in that process. And so what about grandchildren in this process? You know, I said a wise man, you know, we quoted the proverb, a wise man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Well, why would that be? Well, I think one of the reasons is that because in biblical times, one of our jobs or one of the jobs of parents was to make their children successful. And if you make your children successful during your lifetime or help them become successful by by giving them the incentives, by building in some of the character that we've talked about, by using your resources to encourage them to get the education and the things that they need, then their needs are met to that extent, and you can focus on your grandchildren, which, frankly, I'm coming to believe is more fun than spoiling your own children. And so, so that's kind of the perspective that I'd taken. And that's an interesting perspective in America, because we tend to think of everything as individual, whereas in other cultures, family becomes very important. And we help make our families successful. We build up family values and virtues. We educate various members of our family because they will be able to provide for our family as a whole. So as we kind of come down, rewarding the behaviors that you want to encourage. I'm going to one of the last sheet that you have there is a sheet that will discuss a ways of providing what I call a legacy trust. And I want to lead into that by talking about some of the things that we want to encourage in our children, and then how you can put that into your estate plan. Whether you have a simple will, or you have a revocable trust, or you have a whole series of extensive trusts, you can still provide the same basic concept that rolls forward. One of the reasons I had you kind of sum up what your estate's worth and what the inheritance might be worth for each of your individual children is I wanted you to see how much money conceivably you could be dropping off at one point to your children in their life. Because how many of us would go to our kids and say, you know, son, you've been such a great kid. You don't have to work for the next couple of years. Just take it off. Anything you want, your mom and I will provide it for you. Just do whatever you want, and we'll pay for everything. You need that new car? Fine. Well, we wouldn't do that during our lives. But that's what we're doing when we drop off a significant inheritance to a child at death. We're going to stunt incentive at that particular point, and we're going to cause potentially some spending habits that could be very detrimental to them as they roll forward. By prolonging things in a trust, by making a trust become a chicken that lays eggs over a period of time, or by giving some business assets in some other form, what we're really doing is saying to our kids or to our grandchildren, you know, your mom and dad, we're going to be with you always. And those things that we would have paid for during our life are going to continue to be paid for. And those things that we wouldn't pay for, we're not going to pay for. And if you want those other things, then by golly, you're going to have to earn them yourselves. And so let's look at the kinds of things that we might want to reward. Education. And again, I have more education. My wife tells me I have more education than I need. And so, but I tend to value that. But the idea is that you get educated so that you can do what you really love to do, and you can become good at doing what you can do. Whatever you do, if you're really good at it, you're going to be successful, and it's going to be a good living for you. And so part of that process is education, whether that's a college education or a technical education or other kinds of educational sources. I want my estate to pay for that for my children and for my grandchildren. As I look back over the last particularly 8 years when I put 3 kids through college, I think, man, I wish my parents had gone to this seminar because of all the things I wish I'd been able to set money aside for, just to be able to have some help in that area would have been a tremendous benefit to my wife and I, in addition to my kids. Okay, next one. Ministry service. This is something that I've become, you can catch me later on this because I'm just absolutely adamant on this nowadays. If you have kids as they're growing up today, there's so many opportunities that we have for children and grandchildren to be involved in ministry experiences and to take mission trips. And it can literally change your life. 4 years ago, my youngest daughter died in an automobile accident. And that will turn your life upside down. With 3 older kids then that were away from home at college, one child was still at home, and after that we were really struggling to try to figure out what we wanted to do. And when an event like that happens, family becomes extremely important to you. And it became intensely important to me that I be able to spend more time with my adult children and that I have more of an influence on them. And so we got the opportunity to go over to Thailand. These are my two oldest here, my wife, and got to minister with some missionaries up there in a village environment, and got to spend that time. And what was the neatest thing that I can't really convey completely to you is my kids had been on mission trips with youth groups before, and what you do in a youth group ministry is you relate to kids in another environment is about what it is. Yes, there's ministry that goes on, and that's an important experience. But to get to see my kids actually minister and to be able to push them forward so that they prayed for people and that they get a chance to give their testimony, I was just so blessed because I saw that all those things that we tried to pour into our kids as you're growing up that you thought they never listened and they never heard, some of those things came back. And so it was... So again, I'm big on that deposit that comes from the kids. In fact, my son here, who's 23, we were talking about a vacation down in Mexico that we were going to have as a family vacation coming up in June. And he said to me, you know, this was over Christmas, and he said, because I was telling him, you know, you need to save money to make this trip down to Mexico because we'll provide the place. And he said, you know, Dad, that sounds great, but I'd really rather go back to Thailand. And so he's going back with me in next month. And his girlfriend, fiance, is coming, and her mother is coming along with us. And so it's beginning to spread out. But that's, anyway, neat thing. So if you get the opportunity, click again there. Okay. To pay for ministry experiences, grandchildren, children, do it. And if you can go with them, that's even better. Medical expenses, this is becoming an important issue because I found out when I moved 10 years ago, I moved from Navigator staff into private practice for a period of years. And because my wife had medical problems, she was uninsurable. And that was an interesting fact to find out. But kids today, as they start their own business or depending on what they do, medical expenses and medical insurance might be an important thing to be able to provide for their family. Much better than a new car every year. Down payment on a home. Why a down payment on a home and not, you know, buying a home for the kids? Well, the answer is simple. If you give a child a down payment, then they have to qualify for the loan. If they qualify for the loan, then they're qualifying according to their income level at their standard of living. If you give them a home, or if you give them, or if you buy them a home, then they could be qualifying for a home which is out of their standard of living. And so that's an important thing. But I would not have gotten my first house if my parents didn't help me with some of the down payment. And so I'm pretty big on that. Loans for business startups. I'm not a big fan of giving kids money to start businesses. I loan them money to start businesses to pay back to the family trust or to pay back to me. Why do I do that? Well, people feel a lot more responsible with a loan. And now I'll make it very reasonable, you know, 3 or 4% interest, but it's loaned to be paid back so that it can be utilized for other purposes. And then, of course, they have to convince people that this one. Family vacations. A new one I've just added here. And this is because all three of my kids now are outside the home and they live in California and we live in Colorado. And I'm thinking, you know, family vacations are pretty important to be able to get the family together. And what I realize is that young kids working do not always have the money to go on a family vacation. And so sometimes what we can do is we can provide the environment to say, okay, you know, through our trust, even after we're gone, during our lifetime, we're going to get a place that you can drive to, and we'll pay for the facility. You all come because we want to have you relating to your brothers and sisters and to have grandchildren knowing each other. That's important to us. And so we want to value that. And even after we're dead, we want that experience to go forward because we want grandchildren to know each other, and we want that to be a legacy that comes out of our family. And again, I'd much rather pay for that than I would, you know, a sports car or something else. So as we work through this, plan strategically and not tactically. Too many planners today are product salesmen. And they're not planners. They will not problem solve with you to do these kinds of things. And so you need to go in with that idea and say, this is what I would like to do. And that's what that worksheet will help you do. It'll help you figure out what kinds of things you want to provide for so that when you go into a planner, you can say, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to have this money set aside. You know, so many of us have insurance policies as well as retirement plans that are there in case we die. And when we die, then our family is going to have a large sum of cash that we never had during our lifetimes, at least not that discretionary income. And so where is that going to go? And if you believe that your wife may need some of that discipline as well, then you can set up a trust to help her the same way you would help children. Now, I'm a little bit more sensitive to control issues there, but I also know what happens at grief and times like that. And so it's good if you know to even put a trusted advisor along with your wife in that planning process, just so that there's some checks on things that she may be feeling, and she may never have had to make all of those financial decisions by herself. I just want to cover briefly kind of a charitable interest. I'd be really remiss if I didn't put in something related to charity. I was coming out of the Baptist church after John Crawford spoke there. And he said, that was the best sermon on giving I ever heard. But anyway, if you're not going to plan and you don't want to put the time in, then I would say leave all the money to charity. Because in the long run, it's going to be a lot more of a blessing than potentially ruining your children's lives. But there's some other things you can do with charitable gifts and death. The first thing is you can leave a percentage of your estate to charity. And almost everybody can do this, or anybody can do this, whether that's 10%, 15%, 20%. It's like a tithe. How many of you ever thought you could get along in life by giving 10% away to the church when you first earned it, before you began to tithe? Well, we don't think that way, but we know that the Lord provides our need, and so that's an important thing. A remainder interest. That means that if I have younger children and they, I want everything held together until all the things have been provided for them that I should have provided as a parent. They got their education, they got health care, they're on their own. Then at that point, we can split it up and have part go into a trust and part go to charity if we want to. Contingent gift means if all members of my family die, automobile accident or whatever, then at that point, a significant portion of my estate goes to charity. You can use a family foundation. In a family foundation, I don't want you to think so much about private foundations as we've got concepts today called community foundations. And if you're interested in this concept, we have a community foundation in Colorado Springs, which is a community foundation formed around the Christian community. And we call it the New Horizons Foundation. It has many navigators on the board, but it's designed to allow individuals to set up small amounts of money for foundation giving. And so even if you have $50,000 or $100,000 that you might like to give away to a variety of different charities, or if you support a navigator rep and you want to make sure that family is supported for several years after your death, money can go into that foundation and be distributed over a period of years, or you can designate it so that your children can give that money away. And there's a very small annual administration fee on it, 0.5%, and so it is a very economical way to do it, and your estate gets a full charitable deduction for that. So I'll just put that in your mind. If that rings a bell and you want to talk to me some more about that, this is a great concept. I put it together 12 years ago, and it's now grown to where we have 240 different accounts, individual project operating that, over $41 million. Charitable trusts for retirement assets. Remember we talked about the income tax on retirements. I'm going to go real quickly here. One of the ways that you get around that, next, there you go. Charitable remainder trust. Charitable remainder trust pays income to charity for a period, or income to your heirs for a period of years, and then goes on to charity. If this is structured, let's take that $500,000 retirement asset. When it goes into the charitable remainder trust, that can be liquidated and sold, and there's no tax on that transition. Then an annual income of $50,000 a year could be paid out to your heirs for 10 years. So basically $500,000 would be paid out over a 10-year time period. And then after that 10-year time period, it goes on to charity. Well, this is kind of what we call a give-it-twice trust, because you can provide for children over a period of years and then also provide for charity as well. That income then also comes out every year. So it's not giving a lump sum, but it's giving an amount of income annually over a 10-year time period. And what happens so often is that we find kids will get a small inheritance up front, they'll spend it quickly, and they'll learn from that process. And so the fact that it's delivered over a period of time, every year that goes by, you'll find more and more planning that occurs on the part of those kids. And ultimately, you're making the charitable gift. When you structure it this way, you avoid the income tax on it, which is a good thing. And then you're also making a pretty significant gift to charity, but it's a future gift to charity. And as we look in terms and think in terms of future value of giving, if we looked at it, the future gift of $500,000 versus the income value, that's worth about 25%. And so to do this kind of a giving arrangement basically means that you're giving 25% of the value of that asset to charity, 75% of your kids. If it came through and you paid the income tax on it, what's the ordinary income tax rate now? Well, yeah, 28, 33 when you consider state taxes, 35 maybe. So for relatively about the same amount, you could be provided, you can give to the charity instead of the government. And what's the nice thing about charity? We pay our taxes when? At the beginning, we make the charitable gift at the end.
Okay, a couple questions.
Yeah.
When does the charity get the money? Is it years down the road or right away?
No, it gets it 10 years down the road.
And the annual income goes to the heirs. That's tax-free?
No. Okay. It's taxed as it's earned in the trust. And so we can, we can have capital gain income, or we can have ordinary income, but it comes out to them over a period of years, rather than if they get it all at once, then they're automatically in the top tax bracket. So, there is some tax on it, but it's not the same.
It's taxed at their rate, not the trust.
Yeah, taxed at their rate, absolutely. Yeah, yes, sir.
There's no way to put sheltered money into that unit trust, like that 401k.
Boy, I'm glad you asked that question. There has not been a way, except there is one great way to do it. The only problem is you have to die. And and so as a tax planning strategy, that's been kind of difficult. But a new tax law, or a new charitable planning law, was just passed, has just passed the House, and is headed toward, no, just passed the Senate, and is headed toward the House. It's got Sam Brownback on signing on the bill, and Hillary Clinton. You talk about variety there, and the President Bush has already recommended it, and so it's on its way. And that is it will enable you to transfer your retirement assets directly to a charitable remainder trust during your lifetime, provided one that you're over 67 years old. So it has to occur after you're 67. Then you can convert and do this. What some of the advantages that will come of that is I don't have to make annual distributions out of this charitable trust. I can invest it in such that it grows. So if you don't want it, right now you have to start taking distributions at 70 and a half. And so this would enable me to keep it. And so in other words, if I don't need it for our support, then it can go on to a charity. Or a lot of people are putting their wives on here and then their children for a term of years in addition. The one disadvantage is that ordinarily I get a tax deduction when I make this transfer. It's for whatever the charitable value would be. So when I